Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello, welcome back to another classic replay from the archives of Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, and well, this week's classic replay takes us back to something admittedly pretty grim. It stirred up a very heated debate back in 2013 when, in the USA, Kermit Gosnell was being tried on counts of murdering children born alive in illegal late-term abortions. Well, Dr. Trevor Stammers is a Christian former GP who refused to personally refer women for abortion. Dr. Evan Harris is a former Liberal Democrat MP and atheist who believes that women should have the choice to terminate their pregnancy. Well, they discussed the Gosnell case along with Telegraph journalist Timothy Stanley, one of the first in the UK to report the case in the mainstream press after claims of a so-called media blackout around the Kermit Gosnell story. They also discussed the case of Savita Halappanava in Ireland, who died from a miscarriage after being refused an abortion, as well as the current abortion law in the UK. So just be aware, this is a sensitive topic, and the issues being discussed are, of course, of an adult nature. Just a warning as we get into today's podcast. So let's go back to 2013 in today's classic replay.
Yes, and today's discussion topic is abortion, a very emotive issue and one that we always get massive amounts of feedback on every time that we cover it. But recent cases, especially in the US, of Kermit Gosnell, who's being tried on counts of murder of babies born in late-term abortions, has certainly brought the whole issue to the fore again recently. And of course, there have been issues over here in the UK of late, not least the case of Savita Halappanava in Ireland, where her widow claims that she would still be alive if she had been allowed an abortion. She died because of a miscarriage. And there's been various other stories, and perhaps we'll bring some of them that have made the news over the last year or so. So I thought time to address this subject again, and two medical doctors join me to discuss the issue today. Dr. Trevor Stammers, as I mentioned earlier, is part of Unbelievable, the conference this year. He's on the show today. As a practicing GP, he refused to refer women for abortion. Part of the Christian Medical Fellowship, he believes abortion law in the UK isn't being enforced properly. So we'll find out why he believes that in a moment's time. Dr. Evan Harris is the former Liberal Democrat MP. He is one who believes that women should have the choice about what to do with their body and with pregnancy, and very much a leading secular voice in the UK. So great pleasure to have you both with me, gentlemen. Thank you for joining me today.
Pleasure.
Start with you, Evan. Coming back to your background, people may not be aware that you started off in medicine, didn't you?
That's right,
your political career.
That's right, and that gives you the more of the ability, I think, to talk about these issues in politics, because they're highly controversial, and anyone who puts their head above the parapet can get a lot of hassle, and if you have a medical background, it sort of gives you, quotes, permission, close quotes. I don't think you should need that. I think politicians should be free to speak and should feel free to speak, but many don't. My interest in medicine, my interest in the subject came from an interest in medical ethics more than the practice of medicine.
And in the time that you were practicing medicine, did the issue come up in a practical sense? Were you in a sort of position to make judgments on abortion and so on?
I mean, as a medical student, you train. I didn't practice as a junior hospital doctor in obstetrics and gynaecology, so it didn't come up as a in terms of my practical experience, except as a medical student, where you have theoretical and practical training. It's mainly a public policy issue. I don't think. I think you don't need to have direct practical experience to discuss and debate this on either side, because the ethical issues are clear. The ethical, philosophical, and for some people, religious positions are sufficient to give you enough material to get stuck into this important public policy matter.
And it's something you've spoken out on a number of times. For you, it's an issue of the female right, reproductive rights, essentially.
Well, I've spoken about it because there's not that many people, as I've said, in politics who are willing to speak out on a pro-choice side, because it's you get quite a lot of vicious attacks, both from the right-wing media and from people, some of whom claim to be, you know, good Christians, but they can get very vicious and personal. I'm relatively thick-skinned, or was by the end of it, so it wasn't an issue. But I've got many more media calls than was my fair share as a pro-choice politician, because there were such an overwhelming number of politicians in both houses at the time I was an MP were pro-choice, very small number willing to do radio discussions on it. So I got well above the average.
Well, thank you for coming in to do a discussion today. Trevor, thank you for coming in as well. Your first time on the show today. But tell us a little of your background then, for those who aren't familiar with who you are. You for a time were chair of the Christian Medical Fellowship.
Yep.
And for a good number of years also, of course, a practising GP.
Yes, I qualified in 1980 and was a general practitioner for almost 30 years in the same practice, but during that time got very involved in medical teaching, and particularly as time went on, as Evan developed an interest in medical ethics, and I now am in full-time academia, leading a program in medical ethics and law, which I've been doing for 2 years now, so I don't see patients now, but did.
When the issue came up of abortion as a GP, what was your way of dealing with that? How would you advise people who came to you seeking an abortion?
Well, in my early years in practice, when I saw women seeking abortion, it was my usual custom then to refer to the local gynecologist for an opinion to be given, but in order for a termination to be legally carried out in this country, the doctors who are in agreement with it have to sign a form, and there's a form of words on it that says, you know, that I in good faith more or less believe that this will benefit the woman concerned. And I've always had very grave reservations about the benefits of abortion, so I could never sign such a form, and never did, and usually mentioned in the letter that I had to refer because my understanding then was that the law obliged me to do so. But as time went on, there were three major changes that took place that made me change my policy. I think the first one was that as the 30 years developed, I had an increasing incidence of patients who had terminations, and at the time they had them, they were obviously quite convinced it was the right thing to do. And one particular case I can think of had an abortion in the very early years after the passing of the Act, and her gynecologist had written a 2-page letter saying why he thought it was the right thing to do as well. And then that particular patient, one of her subsequent children died. And she was on the phone to me, and her opening line was, "Dr. Stammers, I've got to talk to you because my son is dead, and I feel this is a judgment on me from God for having had an abortion." Now, my immediate response was to, say to her that heaven help us all if, you know, God treats us in that fashion, and I didn't at all agree with where she was coming from, but it was an eye-opening experience to me to see that 20 years on after that termination, it was still a very real thing for her.
Mm. And at the religious guilt is a powerful.
She wasn't a religious person, actually, and neither was the mother of the young girl who I referred for a late termination, who, after she'd had that termination carried out, the mother rang me from the hospital ward to say, would I go up to the hospital? Because her daughter was screaming. In terror. Well,
you can't be not religious though if you think God is punishing you for something you did years before. You can't be non-religious. I mean, you may not be religiously practicing, but there's plenty of people I know who are not religiously practicing who still feel guilty, rightly or wrongly, about things they've done based on their religious upbringing.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking along the lines of there are no atheists in the trenches. Certainly the second case I've spoken about, it was nothing to do with God at all. It was the trauma of a young 17-year-old having to deliver a dead baby for which no one had prepared her. One issue that made me change my mind.
We'll get into some of these issues, especially around the issues of religious conscience and whether, that, as you say, Evan, there is sort of religious sort of stigma attached to the issue of abortion and so on, perhaps a little later on in the show. At the outset, I think it would be good to introduce a third voice on the show today, because part of the reason that made me want to approach the issue of abortion again is that lately in the US there's been, well, of late at least, a high-profile case going on, the case of Kermit Gosnell, an abortion practitioner being tried on counts of the murder of several babies born in late-term abortions and of one woman who actually died under his care. It's alleged that the conditions of his practice were unhygienic. There were unqualified employees performing these medical procedures. One woman, as I say, died during an abortion from an overdose of anaesthesia. I should say as well, as we get into the programme today, that if you're of a sensitive disposition, if you've perhaps got children in the room, you're listening to the show on the Saturday afternoon, I just warn you that we're obviously tackling emotive issues and frankly some of the subject matter is a bit grisly on the show today. So that's just a preface to what's being spoken of today, to give you a warning. But this particularly has, I think, brought the whole issue to the fore because of the graphic nature of what's been presented in the case, what was going on in this abortion service. Terminations were performed after the state's 24-week limit, and some of the people who have testified in the case say that they saw live babies being born and then having their spinal cord snipped with scissors after they'd been born, that they saw movement in the babies and so on. This sort of applies to the rules on what I think is sometimes termed partial birth abortion in the States, that the baby has to be dead before it's delivered and so on. They say that wasn't the case. But it's raised the whole question of these types of abortions, especially these late-term abortions and the kind of practices that actually go on in those who do, in the practices of those who provide abortions. A lot of people on both sides of the debate have been somewhat concerned, even horrified at some of the practices that have been described because of this case coming to light. Well, just to sort of key us in a bit on this is Tim Stanley. He's a US historian writing for The Telegraph, splits his time between the USA and the UK. Now, you've been following, I understand, Tim, this case just for the last few weeks, because up to that point, you actually hadn't been aware of it. And some people have been talking about the idea that there's been a media blackout of sorts around this case. Would you like to comment on that?
Well, there's no official blackout, but this case really came to people's attention in 2011. But the mainstream media did not cover it until very, very recently, partly because it was picked up on blogs and on the internet, and that compelled them to talk about it. When asked why they didn't talk about it, the media gave answers that were frankly unsatisfactory. The crime reporter for the Washington Post was asked directly, and she replied that she only covers local crime. That's quite absurd. If there's a gun shooting in a school, then the Washington Post would quite rightly cover it, even if it didn't take place within Washington, D.C. But for some reason, when it comes to stories surrounding abortion, mainstream media outlets clam up and prefer not to talk about it.
And now that the case has broken a bit, has that sort of have people been talking about it more generally, or is it just the nature of this case that is sort of putting a pause on people actually reporting the facts?
I think in some instances, people are worried about talking about something that is frankly quite disgusting. I mean, the details of the case are horrific. But again, had these babies at these fetuses, whatever you want to call them, had they been 2 years old rather than just been removed from the womb, and had a man been put on trial for killing eight people that way, then I presume the mainstream media would cover it. But because they are fetuses or babies, whatever you want to call them, the media clammed up. But no, certainly now attention is on it, and quite rightly so, because it raises questions not just about this individual, but also it brings to the public's attention what actually happens in a late-term abortion, what the risks are, how surprisingly poorly regulated this business can be, and how exploitative it is.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So something of an ethical issue today that divides very often Christians and non-Christians. How aware were you, Evan, of this case, this Kermit Gosnell case? Had it reached your ears only recently?
I was aware of it, and as I say, I can't really comment on the degree to which it's covered in the US. I have enough trouble in my day job dealing with the vicissitudes of the British press and the way they refuse to give adequate balance to various issues and misreport health scares like the MMR health scare and fraud. So, but I'm surprised in a sense, given the wide range of outlets that exist in the US. I imagine that Dr. Stanley there's complaining mainly about the mainstream networks, because you know there's Fox News and a whole series of individual very partisan broadcasters as well as newspapers that are able to, if they wish, report anything they like and broadcast in a way that's, as you all know here at Premier Christian Radio, is quite restricted in this country. We don't have anything goes in broadcast terms. So I'm somewhat surprised.
But
it's not my area of expertise, the US media.
Of course.
I think what is clear, and it is interesting, is that when you have restrictions on abortion, you do get illegal provision, and this was clearly illegal and unethical provision, similar to the sort of backstreet clinics that we had in this country before abortion was lawful. So
the whole point, Evan, was that it was a legal clinic. Carrying out legal abortions.
Well, he clearly wasn't carrying out legal clinics.
It was a legal clinic.
He was doing was clearly illegal, otherwise he wouldn't be on
obviously
trial.
It was
My point is that if these women had healthcare insurance that was allowed to cover, Medicare was allowed to cover abortion services, then I think it's much less likely that there would be this unacceptable and illegal practice. And he's on trial for murder. I mean, he's on trial for a capital offence. He faces the death sentence. And that's the point. He applied for membership, as I understand it, of the National Abortion Federation approved scheme, and it was rejected in 2009 by the pro-choice organization because they found his service just wasn't adequate. That should have been a warning to the regulators to have done something about
it. Well, just Tim, as I've got you, obviously what Evan says is the case that he is being tried for doing something illegal. Now, is that is justice being served on this, or is there a wider issue that you're pointing to?
Well, the question, but by the way, it's not been stated yet. It has to be said that what was happening in this case is it is alleged that he's only being tried for the deaths of four children. He's been put at hundreds of children, survived the procedure, and had to be killed while outside the womb, and that he apparently used a pair of scissors to do it, a technique he called snipping, where he would sever the head from the body. Now, everything that Dr. Harris has just said is absolutely right, in the sense that this was a legal practice, but he was doing illegal things. But that's rather misleading, because the issue is less his personal criminality than the bigger issue of what actually takes place in a late-term abortion. And what some people are starting to say is this is not uncommon. This is what this procedure involves, because if hundreds of children survived the procedure and were removed from the woman's body alive, that implies, does it not, that actually children do survive late-term abortions, and it implies that this kind of practice, though presumably done under more clinical and professional conditions, is quite common. The other thing I want to add is that Gosnell exposes the degree to which the abortion providers in America are a profitable industry. This man sold himself as someone who was helping poor women, but he charged $3,000 per operation and had a personal income of over $1 million a year. So this is very, very exploitative, and it exposes what the industry is really motivating.
I disagree and I agree in that order. Let me just deal with the agreement first. Clearly, the exploitative stuff is appalling, and that's why in this country we should be relieved that firstly abortion is available in a tightly regulated way on the National Health Service, and the non-NHS providers are charities. They're not providing profits to shareholders or to owners of companies like they would in the US, where, you know, and but it's strange because the same sort of people who argue against abortion are all in favour of the free market.
Can you assure listeners categorically then, Evan, that this kind of thing is not going on in NHS hospitals, and that in late terminations babies are not being delivered live and being killed in similar ways?
That's where I disagree. Again, that's where I disagree with what Tim Stanley said, because my understanding is that there were seven charges brought originally, around seven
to do with the babies,
the homicides of babies, and that in three cases, three of those, these are seven of the best cases.
Three of the charges were dropped.
Three of the charges were dropped because there wasn't sufficient evidence produced that the babies that were allegedly born alive were viable. In other words, were going to survive. So I'm not sure how much you can weigh the allegations that in hundreds of these cases, even with this apparently criminal doctor working well outside, far beyond what's deemed to be medically acceptable, that one can generalise from that. Now, in this country, the position is that if a viable baby is born during an abortion procedure, then it clearly would be a criminal offence in this country for that baby to be killed, and that doesn't happen. Mm. Well, if it does happen, then there's been a massive
before it's
outrageous
born in this country.
Yeah.
I'm just dealing with the question that was put, I may, Trevor.
Okay, yeah,
and
sure.
So there would be an outrageous, scandalous cover-up, which I don't think is happening in this country. And clinical practice is carefully regulated because we have. The NHS providing this service, particularly for late-term abortion. It's the NHS that often does it because these are difficult procedures, both psychologically and technically.
Absolutely.
It's often, Evan, as you know, a large proportion of abortions in this country are provided by certain charities that are paid by the NHS to do it.
Yep.
And I think that it is highly unlikely that in late-term abortions every attempt to commit feticide, to kill a fetus in the womb, is successful. And I'm pretty sure that there will be occasions where these babies are born alive. And what happens to them?
If they are capable of living, it's a criminal offence to kill them. And there's no evidence, you know, because this is very strong claims you're making, both whether it's the NHS or other providers, there's no evidence that in this country homicides are taking place, and I think you have to be quite careful.
Well, let's just ask Tim before he has to go. I know you're busy producing your latest pieces for the Telegraph, Tim. The third thing that you mentioned in when you broke this story on the Telegraph was that this reopens the discussion about the nature of late-term abortions, because for you it raises that whole question of, well, what exactly is the difference between a baby that is born live and then killed and a baby in the womb that is killed at that point? And there is this interesting sort of idea that somehow the baby acquires different rights as soon as it reaches open air, as it were.
Well, exactly. It becomes a bizarre ethical debate around geography, a matter of inches. The baby within the womb, it's okay potentially to terminate it within the womb. But for some reason, when you remove it under American law, it does not become okay to terminate it. I'm not using that as an opportunity to say, let's ban all abortion. What I want, and what I think activists in America hope will happen, is this will raise an ethical question about when life does begin and get people thinking about what's actually involved in abortion. I also want to throw in that the blackout wasn't just on the part of the media. It was also on the part of state regulators. And it says something about the nature of abortion, that local politicians were unwilling to really apply rigorous standards to abortion clinics and were unwilling to really send people in to look out, to make sure they were running correctly. But also the abortion lobby itself, Planned Parenthood, has admitted that it was approached by women who underwent treatment in Gosnell's clinic. Those women complained, and Planned Parenthood then told them to go and write a letter to the Department of Health. They didn't go to the police. And Planned Parenthood, this very important, powerful abortion lobby that just last week the president addressed and said, God bless you to, at the end of its speech, Planned Parenthood has said, or a lobbyist for Planned Parenthood has said, that in her opinion, whatever happens to a baby, if it has survived an abortion and is left lying alive on the table, is between the mother and the doctor. So I hope this whole thing exposes some of the extraordinary myopia, some of the, I think, frankly, cruelty and callousness, and the way in which people just don't want to confront the physical ethical and moral realities of what the abortion industry is about.
It's fair to say that, thank you so much for your contribution as well.
Of course, Planned Parenthood aren't here to answer for themselves, and I suspect they're not hugely concerned about what is said on a Christian radio
Perhaps
station
not
in London.
In the UK, no.
But I think it's important to note, and I've just done a quick Google search, that the allegations that Tim has made, that I find are almost exclusively, I haven't had time, made on Christian blog
pro-life
sites.
In
the US. That doesn't necessarily mean they're wrong, but I really think
story
that if
was
allegations
broken
are going to be made
UK.
About an organisation, then an effort should be made by you, perhaps.
Well, we will indeed. We will. I will ask for parents.
So that they can
deny. Well, I have done that, and if people read my blog, they'll find those allegations.
One of the great things about Tim's blog.
Thank you for joining us, Tim. I do appreciate that. Well, I will certainly ask for
plans. He's a polemicist. And Tim's great to read.
You're not, Evan.
I don't pretend in this debate that I'm giving both sides because I have someone debating.
Okay.
But bloggers at the Telegraph have a specific.
Of course.
Mode of operation, a specific line that they are well rewarded by the Telegraph for pursuing,
and
I just think every claim should not be accepted.
Absolutely.
What about the claim then that's been well established of illegal abortions happening in this country on the basis of sex selection? I mean, I make the general point that I would argue that doing abortions actually desensitizes full-time abortionists, particularly, to their own humanity. And we've all seen the exposés of the consultants agreeing to do illegal abortions on sex selection grounds. Illegal abortion in this country is a very, very real problem. One reason why I have no confidence
I'm
in British
abortion
providers.
I'm going to pause you there, and Evan can come back. We're going to a break. We must just take a quick break, and then we'll come back on that very question these issues.
Again, I think you have to be very careful about full-time abortion.
Okay. Come back in a moment's time. Evan Harris is with me in the studio, a former MP and a pro-choice advocate. Dr. Trevor Stammers also, when he was a GP, he refused to refer women for abortion. We're going to be continuing to address some of these cases that have come up and now in the UK as well regarding the rights and wrongs of abortion. Back in just a moment. This is the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Two guests with very different views joining me in the studio. It's a lively debate today. A big ethical issue, is abortion wrong? And all kinds of stories that have come out in recent weeks, in fact over the last year, that we could discuss. But particularly in the first half of today's programme, we were looking at this case of Kermit Gosnell, the abortion practitioner being tried in the States on several counts of murder of babies born in late-term abortions. Some of the details are quite graphic, so I do again just urge, if you're listening and you are sensitive to that, or perhaps there's young ones in the room, just to be aware of that as we continue the discussion today. I'm joined by Dr. Evan Harris and Dr. Trevor Stammers to discuss this. Just as we were, I had to cut you off mid-flow, gents, in that last section, but you had raised the issue, Trevor, of when apparently there was an expose last year of sex selection, that GPs allowing abortions to take place because of the wishes of parents to have a child of one sex or another. This particularly obviously applies to cultural issues sometimes when people from a certain background would rather have a male child than a female one and so on. And there was this worry that the rules were being bent to allow for that to take place. You were wanting to respond, Evan, and I had to interrupt you, so go on.
Well, I don't know where we are with the investigations of these cases. So, again, one has to be careful. Mm. But I'm not sure these were GPs, for a start, and I'm not sure these were the actual providers, certainly not the two charities they certainly weren't the two charities that are involved and often the target of attacks by anti-abortion groups in this country, British Pregnancy Advisory Service and Mary Stopes. But I think, again, what I'm concerned about, what I would ask Trevor here to reflect on is making generalizations. So saying full-time abortionists
I was saying that to distinguish them between those who are obstetricians and gynecologists and are not doing abortions all the time, because I actually think that they, by and large, do abortions reluctantly. But obviously those for whom their day job, 9 to 5 and beyond, is carrying out terminations, there is evidence that that desensitizes.
Right, I'm not sure that's right. And I think people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones.
Well, that I worked for who did a lot of abortions, I mean, two swallows don't make a summer, but they showed contempt for women, and I have very, very little respect for them. But it's just two.
That's your subjective opinion on two anecdotes, and I know people who have, and none of them would describe themselves as full-time abortionists. Okay, they're people. It's a specialist area. You would want people doing difficult procedures to be specialised, but even the people that I know come across in television studios actually, who are prepared to talk about it, and of course, it's risky for them. In the United States, people identified as abortionists have been targeted for assassination, and in this country they get a lot of hate mail, so there's reasons why they don't advertise themselves as performing, in particular, late-term abortions. They say that they are doing, and I would agree with them, something that helps women that very few people are willing to do. And as I say, people in glass houses shouldn't use cliches, which I'm about to do, but shouldn't throw stones, because if you take, for example, the Catholic Church, okay, and the cover-up, the widespread cover-up of child sexual abuse, they somehow inured themselves, presumably felt themselves to be good men, not just the perpetrators, but the people who covered it up. And yet, you know, a terrible crime over years.
We all try and defend. They
seem to be dehumanised. So I think,
so
if there's any dehumanity going on, I think there's much clearer evidence of it happening in organised religion than there is in the health service.
Well, I don't live in the glass house of the Catholic Church, so I don't have to defend that particular line. But I totally agree with you that I think there is an inbuilt human tendency to gradually become immune to what is the horrific. And I noticed that in relation to the Gosnell case, you laid the emphasis that, you know, he was carrying out illegal abortions, but no identification with the abhorrent nature of what
you're doing. You're not going to pin that on me. You're not going to say that I'm an apologist in any way for that sort of thing. I agree with.
So you would agree to any
adjective you would use. But that's why in this country we have very careful policing, literally policing, because it's criminal otherwise, of abortion, and very tight regulation of practice.
Evan, why then have we had cases of abortion up to term for abnormalities like cleft palate, which you and
I've never seen the evidence for the allegation, because that would be wrong.
So you can categorically say that they don't take place.
How can you prove a negative? Well, you have never produced the evidence, your side, that for something like cleft lip, okay, which is not a serious fetal abnormality and therefore should not qualify for abortion on the basis of serious fetal abnormality beyond the 24-week limit, that has taken place. Now, sometimes you get cleft lip palate in the context of a much more profound abnormality, a syndrome, a fetal syndrome, and we don't know whether those take place, but these allegations are made, and I would be the first to agree that that's unacceptable. So bring the case. Now, it's hard to bring the case because of medical confidentiality. One would hope these things don't leak out.
And because the Department of Health changed the statistics after the case. Let's talk about
abortion law, because this is something
I agree with more disclosure, by the way, and I supported pro-life, the anti-abortion campaigners, who I think were the Pro-Life Alliance, who argued that there should not be the restrictions on the statistics in terms of general numbers that the Department of Health were trying to stick by. And I'm delighted that, I think it was Josephine Quintavalli, who I often contest with on these debates, won, because there was no need for that secrecy. But you have to protect individual identities.
I'd like to come to you, Trevor, because I believe that generally you're concerned at that the abortion law provisions simply aren't being undertaken properly, that when women are referred to for abortion, it's not certainly sticking to the letter of the law, as far as you can see.
Well, I want to move it, I think, deliberately away from the, you know, the mutually agreed horrific cases that we've been talking about to the more ordinary case, and my experience in 30 years of general practice, of the probably hundreds of young women I saw coming to see me to initially seek a termination, I would say on average, probably when you begin to explore it, it really isn't that young woman saying, I want a termination. Often when you say, well, you know, why do you feel that way? It's because my mum would kill me if she found out, or my dad would kill me if he found out. It's because the boyfriend says he'll leave me, and there is a considerable amount of coercion. And suffice it to say that once you give the patient an opportunity to truly express how they feel and mention that there are alternatives to abortion, and that, you know, you won't be abandoned to just have this baby on your own, and I've never known a mum to commit homicide when finding out yet. About a third of my patients elected to continue with their pregnancy. Now, I don't think I'm a particularly exceptionally gifted communicator, or certainly, you know, not putting pressure on patients. And in my 30 years, there was never any complaint that patients were handled inappropriately. So if I could see a third of the pregnancies continuing, I think the way in which we can bring the abortion numbers down in this country, which I hope that Evan would want to agree is a laudable aim, is to certainly ensure that women are provided with counselling and guidance out with the abortion provider who's carrying out the termination, who clearly has a vested interest in seeing the procedure go ahead. That seems
In theory, abortion on demand is not something the law provides for in this country.
No, but in practice it occurs, because every one of those letters that I wrote in the days when I wrote up to gynecologists, I quite clearly stated the reasons why I thought it would not be in this woman's interest, and they were universally carried out. I've never experienced a termination not being done if a woman wanted it, and sometimes without really exploring whether
issue that two doctors have to give their consent as well. Is that something you dispute? Would you like to see a change in that law? Would you like to see it made easier for women to have abortions?
Well,
Evan?
I mean, in terms of what Trevor just said, I'd like to agree, disagree and agree.
Okay.
So I think it's perfectly right that people should have the opportunity on the basis of information to change their mind. And obviously one's first instinct, I know plenty of women, there aren't women in this discussion, which we accept, I know plenty of women who've been pregnant, some of whom have had abortions, some of whom haven't, and some of those who haven't had abortions have considered it. And it's absolutely right that they should have the space to make those decisions and not pushed into it, okay? But also not put upon out of it if what they feel is in their best interests is to have the abortion within the law in this country. So I don't think there's anything in what Trevor says about his practice that would be, in general practice, that would be considered to be unreasonable. Of course, you say, you know, is this your view? You know there are these alternatives, you won't be alone, and so forth. And that's important, regardless of your view on the rights and wrongs of abortion. Where I disagree is the idea that you don't get that sort of counselling at the moment within the existing provision. There's not a shred of evidence that counselling within either the NHS or the main abortion providers is somehow directional, or that there's a vested interest in terms of some sort of payment, for the counsellors when it's doctors doing it. Of course, doctors have to get the informed consent before operating in any event, and you could argue that they then have, in getting that consent, a vested interest. And where does it end? So I don't think that's a fair criticism. On abortion on demand, I mean, what I would accept, okay, and I think we should be very clear about this, and so I think I'm agreeing, is that if a woman does not want to be pregnant, okay, at, say, 10 weeks pregnancy, it would be not in her interest to force her, against her will, to carry that pregnancy to term and to give birth against her will. I think that would be cruel and uncivilised, and that's why existing abortion law, as in the 1967 Act, unamended in this respect, says that if a doctor believes it's in the best interest of the patient in terms of their welfare to have the abortion rather than continue the pregnancy, then it is permitted. And of course, as it happens, it is more dangerous physically to there are more risks associated with continuing the pregnancy than having an abortion, even up to 24 weeks. Although I wouldn't rely on that, because that's a question of the not being able to eliminate all the risks of childbirth versus being able to absolutely minimise the risks of abortion. But fundamentally, you either agree that a woman shouldn't be forced to be pregnant against her will and give birth against her will and go through labour against her will, or you don't. And there's
okay. Is it that simple for you, Kevin?
I do have some sympathy with what Evan is saying there. I think there are two issues for me regarding that. I think the first is, if one takes, for example, what I think both sides of the abortion debate would agree upon as being a fact now, to have certainly more than one termination of pregnancy, but there is some evidence that just having one termination of pregnancy will increase quite substantially your risk of having a premature baby or premature delivery after that. Now, that seems to me to be well-established medical fact now, and you know, one could refer to the literature, lots of papers out on that. I've yet to see any NHS unit, I haven't looked on the website at the literature put out by these two charities, but I would be very doubtful whether that's pointed out as a possible complication. And in a way, because of the risks associated with prematurity, I actually think that the thousands of terminations, hundreds of thousands of terminations carried out in this country year on year may well be leading to an epidemic of premature babies. At least pays part of it. It's really
the increased risk is not as significant, not as big as Dr. Stammers suggests.
You doubt it's there.
Well, I accept that in respect of two of the things you mentioned, there is an association. But to talk about an epidemic of prematurity as a result of this is a non-evidence-based claim using a term which implies infection, because that's what epidemics are about.
I wasn't implying that at
all. An epidemic.
Wasn't implying that at all. I'm using it in popular parlance.
It's a term of art, isn't it? But,
yeah.
But I can,
yeah.
I've not seen any evidence for an epidemic of prematurity based on this, as opposed to, for example, the use of assisted technology for fertility, which is clearly associated with a risk of
it's a multifactorial thing. That yeah. given that 7 million abortions have taken place, I mean, it'd be interesting to a research topic.
But what is important is that we prevent recurrent abortions in the same woman. I mean, I think that is a huge failure of preventive care, to have multiple abortions in the same woman, because the best care would say that if you don't want to be pregnant, then you should be on long-term effective contraception, and that is easily done during the abortion procedure to insert a contraceptive
coil, for
example.
Do you support the current law as regards the time limit for healthy pregnancies? Is it 20 weeks?
I do. But before we get on to that, just this the issue about counseling. What has been found is that the so-called pro-life, the anti-abortion counsellors, have been shown in a number of mystery shopper taped interviews claiming, and these are many of them stem from religious organizations but claim now not to be religious, although it's tenuous the separation, saying that you know you double your chance of breast cancer
Totally unacceptable.
Indeed,
and I would agree with that.
You've seen those reports in The Guardian of taped conversations. You don't get that despite many attempts in regulated NHS or BPAS or Stopes, abortions providers, thank goodness. So if there is a problem with inadequate information, it is in the myriad of these unregulated anti-abortion counselling services, exploitative of a woman in a vulnerable position to say she has double a chance of getting breast cancer.
If one's into stone throwing, I mean, BPAS have also been had taped conversations of being in contact with arranging abortions in Spain above the 24-week limit. I mean, we had that a few years ago as well, and I think both sides do crazy things.
No, I don't think that's crazy. Well, if that was the case and there was no prosecution for anything...
And there's been no prosecutions for talking about breast
cancer.
Because
it's not illegal to lie to vulnerable women outside the health service. This isn't illegal for life counselling to lie to women in a vulnerable position. I think it's grossly unethical. Not at all.
Illegal terminations.
If there was no ethical case brought. It's not illegal in Spain, okay? So if a woman says, is there anywhere I can access abortion, then it is legitimate arguably, for someone to say, I can't refer you, but this exists. It's like in Ireland.
Okay.
Women in Ireland are told within the law in Ireland that people can come to Britain to get the health care they don't get in Ireland. Sorry, Justin.
We got carried away.
We did, rather.
Let's talk about Ireland, because obviously another case that came to mind when speaking of that is Savita Halappanava, who's died during a miscarriage. Her widowed husband says if she had been allowed to have an abortion, she'd still be alive. What do you make of that, Trevor? That case has obviously been used by those in the pro-choice movement to suggest the law needs to change in Ireland, a place where abortion is still illegal under most circumstances.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's interesting that even in reference, just going back momentarily to the Gosnell case in the States, that there was also a mother who died having a legal abortion under his care. It wasn't just the infants that he killed, and there was also the death of a mother. And both of those instances are tragic, one taking place in a country where abortion is illegal, another taking place in a state where abortion is legal. So maternal deaths do occur in both circumstances. I think the second general point is that Ireland, even though it has no legal abortion except to save the life of the pregnant mother, which is an important point to return to, has one of the lowest maternal mortality rates, and it's certainly about half of what it is in the UK. Now, I think the other point to make, as well as that, you know, any woman's death is a tragedy in these circumstances, is that I, as a simple GP, find it very difficult to see that this was really a case about abortion. It was a case of an inevitable miscarriage where there were several systematic failures of care. I gather that the blood count that was done when she was admitted had indicated she might have infection. No attention was paid to it, and so on. And it seems to me that in a tragic case of mismanagement, those who want to change the abortion law in Ireland are trying to get as much political capital out of that as clearly Evan thinks I've from time to time try to do over an abortionist clinic where awful things have happened. And, it sounds as if there is a legal case, but whether it's anything to do with Irish abortion laws, again, the jury is out on that. And I've certainly spoken to lawyers who say that it would have been perfectly legal for the doctors to have terminated that pregnancy at a much earlier stage, even in Ireland.
Well, I don't disagree with much of that. Again, it's different, and I would counsel against taking an individual case and extrapolating too much from it. But so with that health warning, as it were, there's a number of things that can be said. Firstly, as I understand it, the woman in this case, the widow, has had an apology from the hospital authorities, who stated, not that she was denied an abortion and that's what killed her, because I accept this probably not about abortion, although as I understand it, abortion was requested, termination was requested by the husband and was denied, but it may not be about that, but that too much focus, this is the words as I understand it of the hospital authorities in Ireland, too much focus was on the welfare of the fetus and insufficient on the welfare of the mother. Now, it's unlikely in this country that that would happen, and that presumably is a reflection and a logical reflection of the laws in Ireland, which say that you can't have an abortion except where the mother's life is at risk. And even that was a Supreme Court ruling that didn't actually change the law. So if you're a victim of rape, or you're a victim of incest, or you're carrying a terribly deformed fetus, you're forced in Ireland, unless you can escape, literally escape, to a country where it is lawful. If you were raped by your father or your uncle, you cannot get an abortion in Ireland, a legal abortion in Ireland. If you have a deformed child that's bound to die or not going to be viable, you have to carry it to term. Okay? I just think that's uncivilized and unacceptable. Now, it's a reflection of the sorts of laws that provide for that scenario that it is said, and the hospital authorities have indicated, was responsible in this case. So I could accept, unfortunately I only have my research, the print off from the Daily Mail, so I'm not sure I necessarily have all the facts, but nevertheless I can accept what Trevor says. This isn't a simple case of denied an abortion and died. It's much more profound than that, and I think it's unacceptable in a civilised country for a woman as a result of child, as a result of rape and incest, not to be able to access an abortion. Awful.
I mean, this comes down...
And plenty of Christians, by the way. I'd say the majority of Christians agree that it should be lawful in that situation.
What do you make of those sorts of unusual situations?
Well, I think if one's trading off sort of, you know, one uncivilized behavior against another, you know, to me it's uncivilized that a baby can have a lethal injection given to it in the womb to kill it and to deliver it dead. So I think, you know, one reaches a sort of deadlock there.
Is that right? I mean, I accept what you say about that, but nevertheless, I mean, what you're saying is that you think it is right that, and if you had your way in this country, there would not be abortion available in the, I accept, rare circumstances that I've indicated.
Whether mother's life is at risk, then I do think that termination is acceptable.
But not in the case of rape and incest.
I don't know how many cases of rape that you have personally dealt with in this situation, but I have just a couple in my clinical experience. And one of them sticks in my mind because she was the first girl that I'd ever seen who had become pregnant in those circumstances. And my heart really went out to her. And it was the one occasion where I almost hesitated about whether in good faith I did feel it was the right way forward for her. But I think both you and I, in those hypothetical situations, make a guesstimate as to whether, you know, there'll be a good outcome or a bad outcome. We don't know. What she did elect for in the end was a termination. And about 2 years later, she came to see me about something else. And in that situation, what I had shared with her was that as much as I sympathized and understood with her plight, I couldn't recommend a termination, but I did make a referral to a gynecologist and it was duly carried out. But I had expressed some reservation. She came back to see me about something else a few years later, and she stood in the door, and just as she went, she turned back and she said, "Oh, by the way, I'd like you to know that I often do think about that consultation a couple of years ago, and I think you were right." Now, again, one swallow doesn't make a summer.
But that's not the. I do respect your clinical experience. I genuinely do. But that wasn't the question I was asking about individual cases. I was saying, should it have been a lawful option? Now, in Ireland, it isn't even a legal option for someone who doesn't have any doubt, as many women, you know, who are we to put ourselves in those positions? So we have to move away from that. And I'm asking, is it right that in this country, if people, I think, like you got their way, then it would be unlawful in those circumstances? And that's why people like me do speak out, because there is a public policy debate. In the US, it's going one way, yeah, and I don't want it to go that way in this country.
Very quick response, as we're buffering up against an ad break just now.
Yeah. Well, I'm not an expert on Irish law, but I would again, you know, contest whether actually that would be compelled under the law is as it is at the moment. And again, the situation in Ireland is very fluid. I'm not an expert in these areas because of the X case and so on. I mean, I think it's a moot point in law.
She was allowed to come to this country because it was illegal. What it comes down to is about
differing views in the end on what the person in the womb, the baby, the fetus, whatever we're calling it, actually constitutes. And that will make a massive difference as to what you think the rights of the woman are over the rights of the baby she's carrying. We'll come back to that, hopefully, as we start to just wrap things up in the next section of the programme. So come back again in a short moment's time. This is Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Big ethical issue, is abortion wrong? Looking at some of recent cases that have made the news, both here in the UK and in the USA. My guests today, Dr. Evan Harris and Dr. Trevor Stammers, on both sides of this debate.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So just wrapping up this debate, which has taken us in different directions on the issue of abortion, we got really, I think, gentlemen, to the issue of what are the rights of the woman over the rights of the baby she's carrying. This kind of was partly what the Gosnell case brought up, is the question of why should a baby in the womb have a different set of rights to a baby that has moved, you know, a few inches or so out of the birth canal? And it does flare up this tricky dilemma about what exactly we're talking about when we decide to accord different rights depending on the stage that child's development may be at in the womb. For you, Trevor, do you sort of take the cautious approach, essentially, that, well, if we're uncertain as to exactly what the personhood or humanity of the developing child in the womb is, let's err on the side of caution and just assume they're human from the outset, as it were?
I think that I would exercise the principle that if there is an area of doubt, and clearly there is an area of doubt or we wouldn't be having this debate, that I would rather that area of doubt were given to life. And I think that the most recent furore over the article about afterbirth abortion in the Journal of Medical Ethics, where the ethicists were arguing that because there is no moral change in the journey through the birth canal, that if a woman felt she had reason for a termination a week before delivery, then that child should also be killed on request after delivery, that I agree with the rationale of that.
Can I just reference that as well for those who may be not familiar? This was published last year, I think, in the Journal of Medical Ethics. It was a paper titled Afterbirth Abortion, Why Should the Baby Live? There was something of an outcry at the time when Alberto Guiblini and Francesca Minerva argued that parents should be able to have their baby killed if, for instance, it turns out to be disabled when it's born, that the rights don't change simply because, as you say, of the journey from womb to open air. So for you, though, in a sense, they're right, but it's because they're right, they're wrong. Is that what I'm getting from you?
Well, that's right. Because I agree with the ethical principle, but the practical application that I would derive from that is that we therefore give the benefit of life from the moment of conception, which is the process of conception when it's finished, when the new individual or individuals have begun, because there is no logical scientific point or philosophical point, as far as I can see, from that point to independence from the mother. And, you know, most blokes, I think, are often not independent from their mother, certainly into their teens and 20s. So, you know, we've got a real problem there.
Sure, there's the Jewish joke, isn't there? What does Judaism say viability is? Well, the fetus is not viable under Jewish law until it's qualified for medical school.
So we have a problem, Houston.
But I think what you've done there, Trevor, is ignore the rights of the woman and the perspective of the woman. So there is a difference, clearly. I disagree, obviously, as do, I think, almost all, in fact, all the pro-choice people that I've spoken to with those two philosophers. And philosophers philosophize, and in a sense, in that sense, they add to the variety of life, but, you know, it's quite contentious, and I'm sure they are now getting the sort of hate mail that they might have anticipated they got, wherever they're from. I suspect they sound as if they're Italian. So let's be very clear. The reason that the way British law treats it is that, yes, the fetus does have rights, okay, including up to 24 weeks, but they have to be balanced against the rights of the woman for her own bodily integrity and her own choices. And up to the point at which the fetus is capable of living independently of the mother, that's the point of viability, okay, which has been, which is in law is 24 weeks, and in practice, in my view, is 24 weeks in terms of having a reasonable chance of survival without severe disability. And recent evidence confirms that it's still 24 weeks despite medical advances. It can't get any lower. Then the interests of the mother trump, overcome the interests of the fetus. Okay. Why? After that point, it's much more restricted because you're dealing with a fetus that is viable. After birth, there is no question of maternal bodily integrity. Okay, whereas up to the point of birth, you're forcing, in the case of a fetus, for example, that has no prospect of survival, let's say a fetus with no brain, okay, forcing a woman to go to term and give birth as birth to that fetus, and a baby it would be, yes, okay, in that case, is wrong, okay? If the woman says, no, I would rather have, albeit a late-term abortion, because the anencephaly, that's the term for the condition, has been picked up extraordinarily late, okay, if that's the case. So there is a difference, and the difference is it's in the woman's body.
I think where there's no chance of viability, I would agree with Evan, but those cases are very, very rare. But I just want to come back to this issue of the woman's rights, to which actually I've grown increasingly sensitive as I've got older. Let's do a thought experiment, for example, that if in the future ectogenesis, that's the development of the fetus in a jar or machinery outside the woman's womb, does become possible, straight from IVF, supposing that were to happen. A lot of the reasons that women give for termination are, you know, I can't possibly cope with this pregnancy. And it's not just connected with them carrying that child for 9 months. It's to do with the long-term future. Yes. Now, I was debating this with Claire Fox a few months ago, and I put to her that if ectogenesis becomes the norm, would she think that because the baby is no longer in the woman's womb, that they should not be allowed to switch off the machinery and terminate the life of that child if the husband goes off or the boyfriend's unfaithful or whatever? The majority of reasons for why terminations are carried out. And I suspect that women would still want to end the pregnancy, even though the fetus had no claim
but
upon their body.
Post-viability, I mean, let's be clear, you're not allowed to have an abortion on those grounds after 24 weeks, after the fetus is viable, therefore is capable of independent life, therefore has accrued more rights
in theory.
In our settlement, Church of England.
This is a somewhat this question of viability, people will obviously contest, well, why at that point do we decide that the fetus gets rights? I mean, there are,
indeed,
in a sense,
both sides
a toddler
of the argument
is far
say,
more far
there
more
are people on both sides who say that that's not a valid distinction. So that indeed. I have heard pro-choice people saying, if it's in the woman's body up to term, there should be no restrictions.
I've had Wendy Savage on my show who makes that case. Now, that for me,
it's not the majority pro-choice position, nor is it the law of the land. The law of the land states that in the circumstances, and that's why the ectogenesis, that the term example, is flawed in respect of a viable fetus. Okay, so up to the point of viability, and the analogy that other philosophers have used, if you woke up in a hospital bed and found yourself connected to someone else from tubes, okay, and you couldn't leave for a period of months, would you be committing, should you be committing a crime, or, keep it philosophical, a moral wrong, if you were to exercise independence and crack on with your life, okay? If you found yourself, woke up in that position, and philosophers would say you weren't committing a wrong.
Well, depends which philosopher, I suppose, you'd
speak
to. Well,
but that's the example that's used, so you don't need to go to the example that Trevor used for this
I'm very familiar with that example, of course, but Judith Jarvis Thompson was the originator of it in 1974, but even she says that the woman, if she wishes, can, interestingly, she says she can choose to be a good Samaritan, and obviously seeking to serve one who told that parable, I would want to encourage folks to be a good Samaritan. But I do agree with you that there is a difference between encouraging folks to do it and compelling them. And compulsion is a very difficult area.
It's just that we do get these odd situations in a hospital where in one ward, a baby born at between 20 and 24 weeks, say, doctors are desperately trying to save the life of. And in another part, that baby is being destroyed legally. I mean, it is a strange thing. And are we kind of prepared to honestly say this is the point at which the baby accrues a right to life and that sort of thing?
So you're saying that because a wanted baby is born and therefore is a baby, okay, prematurely at, say, just below 24 weeks, okay, that there's an effort made to
keep the baby alive,
right.
Yes.
You're saying it's incongruous
to me.
On the basis of that
a baby still in the womb can be destroyed at that age. It just seems odd that the medical practice can do both.
Well, there's a distinction, isn't there? I'm sorry to shock you, but there is a woman involved in one and not in the other, okay? That it is inside a woman's body, okay?
But my
so that's why, and she has rights, okay? It may not be, it's not convenient, and I have to say, if I can introduce a note of caution, the rights of women in some theologies, particularly those that are rooted firmly in the Bible, have never been centre stage, okay, as they are in modern liberal democracies, but there's a woman involved, and it is often forgotten that that woman has rights, as we know from the tragedy of this death in Ireland, that if everything concentrates on the fetus, then, as the hospital authority says, her rights can be ignored and overlooked.
We have to start to wrap things up. Thank you, gentlemen, both for being in. And it's been a fascinating discussion, as much as these subjects are obviously very emotive on both sides. Just any final thought from both of you as we head off?
Well, I just say it's important to have these discussions. And I wish that there were more of these discussions and debates in even more mainstream broadcasting outlets than Premier Radio, because it can only be a good thing, because the alternative... because we tend to get on, we respect each other's views. I certainly respect Trevor Salmon's views. But you do get these standoffs, and I just don't want to see the debate descend into the debate that we have in the United States.
I'd absolutely agree with Evan over that, and it's been a far more interesting and challenging morning for me than I'd anticipated. And I would totally agree that Christianity has given women a very, very raw deal hitherto. And I think things are changing, certainly in the neck of the woods where I am. But there is a long way to go. So perhaps the next time you run this debate, perhaps finding two female doctors to debate it may be a good idea. No.
Well, that was our classic replay and how the issues went down nearly 10 years ago in this episode from the Unbelievable Archives. Do let us know your thoughts as usual. You can email me unbelievable@premier.org.uk. If you're interested in attending a live show discussing ethical and biblical issues, then can I recommend that you come along for our special discussion on LGBT and the church happening on the 7th of February. Andrew Bunt and Charlie Bell will be my guests. Andrew Bunt and Charlie Bell are both same-sex attracted Christians, but they take different perspectives on how that should be lived out. Andrew Bunt takes a view that actually the biblical commitments require him to live a celibate lifestyle. Charlie Bell believes that Christianity does not preclude faithful same-sex relationships. So if you want to be part of that discussion, a live discussion on the 7th of February, you can register to be part of the audience and ask questions as well as part of it. That's at unbelievable.live. Do hope you can come along and be part of that. For now, thanks for being with us, and we'll see you next time.